The following program is sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
Good evening and welcome to From the Median, where we are concerned with the middle ground, not just to understand both sides of an argument, but also to awaken the consciences of those who are neutral or indifferent to this, the greatest civil rights movement of all times, the pro-life movement. Listeners, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We have got some really interesting topics to talk about in this next segment of the show. I've got on the phone somebody who you all know very well. He's been with me for, I think, actually, we're going into our 14th year of the program. And I think Wesley Smith has been on the program with us probably at least for 12 of those years. He's been coming and going. And I'm just so always so grateful that he takes the time to come and talk with us all and to share his knowledge, which is great and vast, about all things to do with life. So Wesley, you are with, you're also on National Review, you're an author, you're a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptions, you're an expert in many, many different fields, and so great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Well, I always have to get on with a fellow Smith, right?
Yeah, there we go.
Happy New Year, Mom.
Same to you. Absolutely same to you. So I read an article that you had put out. And folks, if you can get onto National Review or in, you know, just type in Wesley Smith into your Google search or your search machine and subscribe to Wesley's articles, because you'll find that he has a way of getting to the nitty gritty in a very short, sweet, succinct way that leaves the information with you. And that's what I love about Wesley. You don't have to read 15 pages of a review. You can just get that very, very quickly and you understand exactly what this is about. Wesley, we have been talking now about, you've recently put out an article that I think it is very important that we start talking about, and that's euthanizing children. You had a very interesting article about what's going on in Australia with regards to this. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, unfortunately, Australia is legalizing assisted suicide and or euthanasia throughout the country. And in one of the territories where Canberra is, they haven't quite done it, but they're getting ready to do it. And a human rights commission looked into the proposal, you know, the language of the legislation, and they were aghast, not because it legalized euthanasia or assisted suicide, but because it excluded children from eligibility. So they wrote a report.
Let me get that again. They are not aghast at the language, but they're aghast because they didn't put children into the language.
Yes, because in their view, it kept children from getting health care. See, once you decide that killing is a medical treatment, then there really is no way to prevent logically exactly what this Human Rights Commission has suggested to children. And there's no way eventually to say that somebody who, let's say, is under a conservatorship or is incompetent and unable to make their own decisions, that the surrogate could decide to have them euthanized. I mean, that has not yet taken place in the law in one sense. It has in another. But if it's a medical treatment, it becomes a human rights abuse, according to this Human Rights Commission, to exclude anybody from a legitimate medical treatment. And that's the logic of redefining killing into something that's beneficent and part of medicine.
The whole euthanasia push, you and I have talked about this many times. You've come and spoken at our convention about it. Where do you see all of this ending?
I see it ending as death on demand, that we're basically becoming a pro-suicide society in the West, generally speaking. You have in the Netherlands, for example, infanticide takes place. If a baby is born with a terminal medical condition or a very serious disability, under something called the Groningen Protocol, Groningen, people can look it up. It's based in the Groningen Medical Center. It's a bureaucratic checklist for killing babies. And they do kill babies in their bassinets if they are born with serious disabilities or terminal illness. Children in Belgium and the Netherlands are euthanized. There are no age limits those two countries. In Canada, it still requires being an adult, but there's already agitation to include children. And then in Germany, in terms of death on demand, the German highest constitutional court a few years ago issued a very radical ruling that said there is an absolute fundamental human right based in autonomy to commit suicide. There is a fundamental human right based in autonomy to be assisted in suicide if that's what you want. And there's a ancillary fundamental right to assist in suicide if that's what you want. And this right to suicide does not require health or disability or anything of that sort. In fact, the court said nobody has a right to judge why anyone else might want to die. So that ends up with death on demand in Germany in terms of the right to suicide. And that's where this whole thing leads eventually, because it's logical. I mean, human beings are a logical species. We take principles and we take them where they're going to lead. And I don't see any way to prevent that eventually. Right now, of course, there is suicide prevention for veterans or for children. But why? Eventually, I don't see if being made dead or being dead becomes a human right or a medical treatment, I don't see any way to permanently prevent that full slide. It isn't happening now because, particularly in America, because the advocates for euthanasia and assisted suicide know that this country has not fully swallowed the hemlock. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's in part because, in fact, in large part, it hasn't even swept all the, let's say, progressive states. I mean, New York doesn't have it yet. They're trying again this year. Connecticut failed, and now they're trying again this year. Minnesota's trying again this year, and others. But they've got a problem because part of the liberal coalition, which is the disability rights activists, are against legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide because they see themselves as the targets, which they are. And so that makes it harder in progressive states to get it passed. I don't yet know of any red states that have actually passed assisted suicide, but I do know that it's moving in that direction even in the red states because people have lost the concept of the intrinsic dignity, value, and importance of human life.
Mm-hmm. You're so right. I mean, we've just gone through this dreadful constitutional amendment fight here in Ohio. And honestly, it has been such an eye-opener and really helped us, I think, as sad and all as the results were, Wesley, I think what it has done is to open our eyes to the fact that the culture is so far down the line towards just glorifying and honoring death. That just it's terrible.
It's a nihilism that is really appalling. And if you take a look at suicide prevention campaigns, and I often bring this up in my writing, particularly when it's this is Suicide Prevention Day. Well, you never bring up assisted suicide, do you? These campaigns never bring it up.
Yeah.
You can't even find assisted suicide or what's called medical aid in dying, which is the euphemism, on their websites.
Yeah.
And I try to point this out. So I call it, and you also don't see, because there is such a tremendous push in the media in particular for, she died on her own terms, and story after story after story of how wonderful this person got assisted suicide, that it eclipses suicide prevention efforts. I mean, you still see some, in the news. But if you did a media study, I'm convinced, over the number of advocacy for assisted suicide and the glowing reports versus suicide prevention, it would be totally disgusting and shocking how much more the media cares about assisted suicide, because it's edgy and it gets clicks and so forth. But when you only really care about stopping some suicides.
Exactly.
You can't call yourself an anti-suicide culture. You're a pro at least some suicide culture.
Absolutely. And that's very well said, because this is what we're doing. I mean, we're going more and more towards this kind of a culture. I mean, and the culture is, as I say, we've gone so far down the road. The exit polling that we did as a Protect Women Ohio, and I was on the board, and it was just, it's devastating to see how much we have to do. That's why people like you and the writings that you do, and folks, we do need to stay educated. Every day, try and find yourself something to read that helps you to understand why we are so opposed to these types of things. You know, you've just very recently, a couple of days back, you wrote an article about the aborting Down syndrome babies, and the fact that, you know, some people, it's a eugenics program. This is a eugenics program.
Yeah, there's no question. The problem is, you have, you know, the question that I wrote about was in the New York Times Magazine. There is a feature called the ethicist. And it's kind of like Dear Abby, only it's, is this ethical or is that ethical? And the question that was asked in this particular episode or edition was whether having prenatal tests was ethical, because the letter writer was afraid it might be eugenics. And the ethicist said, oh no, it's not eugenics, because eugenics is basically society-wide trying to prevent births of whole categories. Well, prenatal testing isn't eugenics, because prenatal testing is morally neutral. People like Sarah Palin, for example, when she had prenatal tests and found out that her son Trigg had Down syndrome, that allowed Sarah Palin and her husband to prepare for that child.
Yeah.
So in that sense, of course, that prenatal test was not eugenics. Yeah. But the search and destroy mission that is going on often with regard to this issue, where genetic counselors, I've been told by people, have said, no, well, you should get your abortion, right?
Yeah.
The counseling is toward abortion.
That's right.
Where in places like Iceland and Denmark, almost no babies with Down syndrome are allowed to be born. Mm-hmm. And then they'll say, well, we've eliminated Down syndrome. No, you've killed the people with Down syndrome before they could be born. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes eugenics, doesn't it?
That's exactly right.
And the same thing happens with regard to dwarfism and even cleft palate when this is found out. Sometimes there are abortions. So Peter Singer has promoted infanticide for people who are born with Down syndrome, if that's what the parents want to do, if it would cause too much suffering to have that child and so forth. And I can tell you, I'm of a certain age. I remember growing up in my young adulthood, people with Down syndrome were everywhere.
Absolutely.
And they made it for a better society.
Yeah.
They were friendly, loving, caring. I mean, I've never met people as loving as people with Down syndrome. And now we are not wiping them all out, but we're wiping out, what is it, 70% or more in the womb?
I think it's more. Yeah, I think it's more.
Yes,
yeah.
And we're the losers. Not only are the children the losers who aren't born, but we claim we believe in diversity. We are the losers because this great pusher, this great group of people who bring so much gentle joy and allow people to love them unconditionally without expecting anything in return, are missing.
Yes, exactly.
And it's wrong.
Yeah, exactly right. And you know, that's the other thing that you mentioned, dwarfism. I mean, I think that's another whole issue is that those, there's so much that the people with some sort of a disability, so often they bring such joy to us. And you're right, Wesley. We're depriving ourselves of this.
We're depriving ourselves of these people.
Yeah.
And in terms of dwarfism, I mean, the excuse for Down syndrome is, they might have a tough life, although these days people with Down syndrome have a much better life in terms of their medical treatment and life expectancy. And in fact, they're able to hold jobs and so forth, which is great. They're developmentally disabled, but they're able to hold jobs and all of these things. People with dwarfism, there's the only thing that's going to affect them most of the time is that their stature is shorter than most people's.
Yeah, exactly right.
So we're going to take...
Exactly right.
So where's the suffering there? I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, no kidding. It's absolutely ridiculous. One of the other things that
Can I tell an anecdote?
Sure, absolutely.
This is quite a while ago, but I was at I was brought to Grand Rounds at I believe it was University of San Francisco Medical Center, and I gave a presentation on what we were just talking about, the need for universal human equality and everybody having intrinsic equal dignity, and afterwards, somebody came up and they said, look, I'm a genetic counselor. What am I supposed to tell people when their baby tests positive for Down syndrome? What am I supposed to do? Support? And I said, well, how about instead of painting a dire picture, why don't you bring in people who have children with Down, who love their children with Downs, who wouldn't have missed the opportunity to parent those children for a thing? Why don't you bring those people in to talk to people so that they at least get a full view of what that circumstance might be like? And he was gobsmacked. It never had occurred to him.
Yeah. Yep.
And I was thinking, how can you be a genetic counselor if it never occurred to you to bring in
the very people that you're talking about,
yes.
You would think that would be the very first place that they would go to, is to
exactly.
say, oh, my goodness.
I remember Sam Brownback years ago when he was senator, and Ted Kennedy, a bit ironically, they passed a law that said, a federal law that said, look, your counseling has to be neutral, at least. It cannot be abort, abort, abort.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And and they got that through the Senate and signed into law. I don't think there's an enforcement mechanism, unfortunately, but at least they recognize the problem.
Absolutely. Looking at there's another article, and folks, I'm going to put Wesley's National Review place up there where you can go, and you have to subscribe to National Review, but there you can also get a lot of Wesley's articles without actually subscribing. But you can also go, you can just click on his name, and lots of stuff comes up. But one of the things that I recently saw, I think it was back at the beginning of January, so we're still right in the middle of January. So we're okay. But it was about the bioethicists pushing human extinction Oh, my goodness gracious me. Oh, my goodness.
Well, that shows you where the nihilism really does sink in. And there is something called the human extinction movement. And usually, you think, okay, well, yeah, of course, there are people, that might put staples in their faces and be very goth or nihilistic. But the reason I wrote this piece is because this idea of antinatalism or all of us just having no more children so we go extinct. And the point of that is to prevent suffering. So you can see where this fear of suffering is really twisting people's thinking. So, with euthanasia and assisted suicide, we want to eliminate suffering by eliminating the sufferer. And now with this human extinction movement, the idea is to eliminate suffering by not allowing anyone to be born to suffer.
Oh, my goodness. This is just standing on your head.
Yes. And the reason I brought it up is because this thought process, and, everyone's not going to stop having children. There's no question about it. But this infects a culture, this kind of advocacy. And I brought it up because it was published in the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics, which is one of the premier bioethical journals in the world. So this is not like somebody off in a corner with a tinfoil on their heads running their own little tinfoil hats running their little internet site. This is one of the most prestigious bioethical journals in the world. And published with all due sincerity that we all should stop having children because of suffering. And then he brought up, well, and we also have to stop factory farming in terms of animals. And I said, well, okay, there's an interest, there's, a discussion to be had about that for sure. But, the issue of animals versus humans are different. And then he said, well, and we shouldn't bother animals in the wild. And I thought, well, what kind of logic is that? There's more suffering in the wild, you know, red in tooth and claw.
Absolutely.
Than there is among domesticated animals. I have less suffering than usually than wild animals. And certainly human beings mitigate suffering both for wild animals, for ourselves, hopefully. And of course, animal welfare is a very important issue of human exceptionalism. We owe a duty to animals to treat them humanely and not cause gratuitous suffering.
Yeah.
And of course, so factory farming, you know, the treatment of the animals versus the inexpensive food that people can get, which is also a tremendous human good, is worth talking about.
Yeah.
Because animals are not rocks, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But this idea of, well, we shouldn't exist at all. That way there will be less suffering. Hey, there'll also be a lot less joy. There'll also be a lot less love. There'll also be a lot less kindness because animals in the wild are rarely kind.
Absolutely. You know, remember, I don't know whether you remember a little while back when I think it was a dentist or something went on a safari and he shot a lion or something. And there was this the guy had to close down his business and the whole, because it was such an outcry from all, you know, from the extremists. And I remember a doctorate student at one of the very prestigious universities here in America, who was from Africa, and he wrote an article, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that said, excuse me, this is where I lived. This is where I live, right? You know, that's where I'm from. And I can tell you right now, we don't run. If we have a lion in a village, we kill it because it creates incredible, it will eat us. It was the most, he said, we do not name our lions. They're not called Simba. They are called lions and we'll kill them if we can. It was such a, you know, a ray of sunshine and a ray of rational thinking. You don't, we have gone so crazy. And that's probably because honestly, Wesley, we're way too comfortable in so many instances.
I think you put your finger on something. A lot of this is decadence caused by tremendous success.
Yeah.
And so when you lose the struggle in some regards, we become decadent. Yeah. I mean, you see that repeatedly in history. And so I think a lot of what we're talking about are symptoms of a deeper societal malaise. And that is a part of, it's an irony, isn't it?
It sure
that
is.
A great success that we work so hard for ends up undermining the everything things that allowed for, us to become successful.
Yeah, everything we worked for, exactly right. What do you see 2024 bringing to us?
That's an interesting question. I've been thinking about that a bit. I think we're going to see a tremendous push for euthanasia-assisted suicide in this country. Canada is about to allow mentally ill people to be euthanized. As Netherlands and Belgium already do. And of course, sometimes these euthanasias are conjoined with organ harvesting. I think abortion more states will pass radical abortion license laws, and the media will keep lying that it's just Roe v. Wade. And I think that the pro-life movement's going to be on their heels for a while because having caught the car, being the dog that caught the car, I don't think that the pro-life movement quite understood that people want to have access to this for various reasons. And now they're going to have to think about how do they deal with the more difficult issue, which is not the state of the law, but the state of the culture.
Absolutely. Just an ending off, I will tell you that our exit polls show that even Ohioans who believe that life begins at conception, 47% of those people that believe that, 61% of those chose to vote yes on our amendment, yes for abortion. They do not want that option removed from them. They want.
And let me tell you why I think that is. This is just Smith on this issue. People want ready access to sex.
That's exactly right.
And abortion is part of that.
It's a part of. You're absolutely right. So you're right. We have to reassess. We have to look at where do we go. What are we doing? How can we be part of the solution? And I think that's going to be a huge thing. Wesley Smith.
For the pro-life movement, the issue is how many lives can be saved.
Yep.
And the crisis pregnancy center movement needs to grow. And that is part of changing the culture and saves many, many lives, not just of children, but of women.
Of women,
And overcoming this canard that pro-lifers only care about babies before they're born, but not people after, such a lie.
Yeah, that's a media push. I mean,
yeah, and that needs to be overturned and exactly overcome. Right. And that means people need to, they don't like to, brag, but people need to show how pro-lifers actually reach in and help people at every stage of life.
Absolutely. Wes, thank you so much for joining me. I'll be back with you again, call you again soon and get you back on. You're always so interesting talking to you. God bless you, lots.
Happy New Year.
Same to you. Bye-bye. Don't go anywhere. I will be back with you right after this very short break with another world-class, inspiring guest.